Mark Brend is the author of Strange Sounds, Offbeat Instruments, and Sonic Experiments in Pop. One of the unusual instruments Brend writes about is the Ondes Martineau. It was invented by Maurice Martineau, a cellist who served as a radio operator during World War I. He created the first instrument that bears his name in 1928. As Mark Brend told Anne Strangechamps, Martineau wanted to create an instrument similar to the theremin.
To play a tune on it is incredibly hard, and Martineau wanted to do something that had a similar type of sound but was easier to control. So he designed this instrument that you could control in two ways, one of which was with a conventional piano-style keyboard, and the other of which was something that he called a ribbon controller, which was a little sliding ribbon with a ring in the middle of it, and you put your index finger in the ring and moved your index finger up and down in front of the keyboard, the piano keyboard. So when your middle finger was adjacent to the C note, for example, on the piano keyboard, it would sound a C note. And it enabled you to slide between notes, get the glissando effect that the theremin is so famous for, but in a much more controlled way so that you could pitch it more accurately. You could play tunes in it and you wouldn't just make weird noises.
Must be very challenging for a musician, because isn't it like playing a piano and a stringed instrument at the same time?
Yes, it is. I should point out that with the Martineau, you can only use one of the controllers at a time. So you can either use the keyboard or the ribbon controller. But it does have a lot of similarities with a stringed instrument in that it's very touch sensitive. And so that, as well as having the controllers, it has a number of kind of tone type of controls that you can use. And say, like with the violin, the velocity with which you hit the strings, for example, will affect the sound. It's the same with the Martineau. The actual way that you touch the various controls, how hard you touch them and how fast you move your hands, will affect the quality of the sound. So it, for an electronic instrument, it's very unusual in that respect.
The alternative rock band Radiohead has used the Ondes Martineau, haven't they?
Yes, they have. To my knowledge, they're pretty much the only established rock band that have used one. That Johnny Greenwood, their guitarist, found a very late model in Paris, and he was fascinated by it, and they've used it on quite a few of their recordings, Pyramid Song being one of the most famous. But when they play live, they don't take the Martineau out on the road with them because it's too fragile, and he's worried that it will get damaged. So they've got a kind of custom-built synthesizer to replicate the sounds on stage.
Uh-huh. There's one of their songs in particular, Motion Picture Soundtrack. How do you think the Ondes Martineau contributes to their sound in that particular song?
Well, it has this type of sound that is a bit, you kind of listen to it and you think, am I listening to an electronic sound or am I listening to treated human voices? And I always think that it's a particularly good instrument for them because Johnny Greenwood plays it in a way that it quite often harmonizes with Tom York's voice. And it's quite hard to distinguish the two. His voice and the Martineau blend very, very well and share a lot of kind of ethereal characteristics in a way.
Let's talk about some of the other more obscure instruments that you found out about. The clavulin, for instance, what's that?
The clavulin, yes, you see, the French were very good at coming up with these things in the earlier part of the 20th century. The clavulin is a little tiny three-octave electronic keyboard that came with its own integral amplifier. And it was designed in 1947 in France, but mass-produced in the United States and in England, and so was sold on a very, but pretty widely. They were made in their tens of thousands and were very popular. In a way, it's a bit like the Ondes Martineau, but in a much simpler form. It only has a keyboard. It has a number of buttons that you can press in combinations to get a variety of sounds. And it's monophonic. You can only play one note at a time. It's most famously heard on two records that were hits in the early 60s. In a modified form, it's on Del Shannon's Runaway. A guy called Max Crook, who was Del Shannon's keyboard player, had a clavulin that he modified and named the Musitron. And that is the instrument that you hear on that Del Shannon record. And then again, Telstar by the Tornadoes, a massive hit in 1962, and the first British rock record to top the American charts. The lead line on that is played on a clavulin as well.
I know Telstar was a huge hit at the time and expresses a lot that you find really characteristic of the period. Tell me about Telstar and what you like so much about it and what the clavulin contributes to it.
Well, Telstar was largely the work of its producer, Joe Meek, who wrote the song. And although he wasn't a musician himself, he is responsible for the character of the record and the sounds. And I think it's just something that sums up that kind of period of technology. He was fascinated by the space race and going to the moon and all of that type of thing. And in the late 50s and early 60s, there was a great sense that technology would change our lives completely, and there were all sorts of ideas of what the future world might look like. And in many ways, those ideas, when you look back on them now, are quite quaint, you know, that we would all live on the moon in pods or something like that. But there's something about Telstar that sums up that kind of optimistic looking to the future. And I think the clavulin has just got that kind of primitive electronic sound that at the time was very new. You have to bear in mind that electronic instruments barely existed at the time and they'd been rarely heard in public. And so the sound would have been very kind of strikingly unusual to most people who heard it. And that for me all kind of works together in a great package. It's a record that's of its time and sums up its time. But we can look back on it now and still enjoy it, even though in one sense it's very dated.
We have to talk just a minute about the guy who wrote that song, Joe Meek. Mm. You mentioned because he's got to be one of the most colourful characters in your book.
He was a very colourful man. I mean, as I said, he wasn't a musician. He was actually tone deaf, but he loved music and he was very keen on gadgets, electronic gadgets. And he worked as a producer and a sound engineer and built a lot of his own effects, his reverb and echo effects and what have you. He was very secretive about them. But his records, like Telstar and others, had a very distinctive sound that were entirely his responsibility. It didn't really matter what artists he worked with. His records always had his stamp on them. But he was very secretive. And as time went on, that secretiveness turned into paranoia. And he came to believe that people were bugging his studio and that the Beatles were spying on him and that Phil Spector was trying to steal his ideas.
Well, he also had a strong interest in the spiritual and the occult, didn't he?
He did, very much so. He particularly had an view that Buddy Holly was speaking to him from beyond the grave and was dictating hit records to him. And
maybe he did.
You never know, because he had quite a few hit records. But Joe Meek's story, for all its kind of fascination, ended tragically in that he killed his landlady, shot her, and then shot himself on the anniversary of Buddy Holly's death, I might add.
Let's talk some about drum machines, because, I mean, these days they're very common, but that wasn't always the case. We're talking about the period of time when, as you said, there were no other electronic instruments. This was all brand new. Mm. When did the first drum machines come out?
Well, there were, in tiny numbers, drum machines were built by a man called Harry Chamberlain from the late 40s onwards. But they started to become popular, or they started to be manufactured in bigger numbers, I should say, in the early 60s. Various Japanese manufacturers started to make them. But even then, they were incredibly limited, and they didn't sound anything like drums. They tended to be used for two purposes, one of which was to accompany organists. You know, a home organist would use a drum machine as a means of keeping time. And also guitarists used them as just something to practice to so they could keep rhythm. But it wasn't really until the late 60s, when drum machines had been around for getting on for a decade, that musicians actually started to use them in pop and rock records. But even at that stage, they sounded nothing like a drum kit. They sounded percussive and they sounded rhythmic, but you couldn't say that, for example, a drum machine snare drum sounded anything like a real snare drum. But like the clavulin, it had its own distinctive sound that had some appeal, and a number of musicians started to exploit this to great effect, really.
Didn't Sly and the Family Stone kind of popularize them?
Family Affair was a huge hit, a massive international hit. And it showed people that drum machines could be used with a lot of expression, because people criticised them for saying that they were too rigid and there was no dynamic flavour in them. And yet Family Affair is a record with a great groove, a great feel to it. And it's based entirely on a drum machine pattern. There are no live drums in it at all.
It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
Of the drum machine have any larger effect on the development of pop music?
I think they did. I think Sly Stone in particular, because, you know, drum machines are very popular in all sorts of soul and R&B and rap and hip-hop music now. And that's music that tends to place a lot of emphasis on groove and feel and rhythm. And I think Sly Stone, not only with Family Affair, but with other hits, showed that that was possible. And the drum machine is a completely integral instrument in pop music now. Most artists and musicians and bands use drum machines, even apparently conventional guitar groups, say a group like U2 will use drum machines. So it's been completely absorbed into the mainstream of pop music. And I think people like Sly Stone paved the way, showed that that was possible.
Hmm. Well, you're also a musician yourself, and you put together a group called the Strange Sounds Orchestra.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, and you've got some songs on the CD that comes with your book. What about Omnichord Theme? Tell me about that one.
A lot of the instruments I've become interested in were designed as a way to make music accessible. And the Omnichord is one of those things, in that it's something that you play simply by pressing buttons, really. You press chord buttons. It has some of the characteristics of an accordion, where you have chord buttons, but it's electronic. So it has a little built-in drum machine, it has chord buttons, and it also has, well, the harp part of the Omnichord is a kind of what they call a strum plate, and you run a plectrum along it and it makes a sound like a harp. A very curious thing. And the little bit of Omnichord music on the CD is made entirely with one Omnichord, just played off straight.
That's amazing. And what about your other song, A Strange Sense of Liberty?
That has probably about 20 instruments on it. There's a rhythm ace drum machine, one of the first drum machines, a clavulin, a jew's harp, a mountain dulcimer, a ukulele banjo, various Casios, a stylophone, which was a toy instrument that David Bowie used. So lots of instruments all on that track.
That's Mark Brend and the Strange Sounds Orchestra with A Strange Sense of Liberty. Brend is the author of Strange Sounds, Offbeat Instruments and Sonic Experiments in Pop. He spoke with Anne Strange Champs.